The son of a Baptist pastor, Garrett Connolly, was deeply embedded in church life in small-town Arkansas, attending services three times a week and silently struggling with his sexuality. Outed to his parents at 19, he faced an ultimatum. Go to Love in Action, the largest ex-gay therapy organization in the country, and be cured of his homosexuality, or risk losing his family, friends, and church community. So he went. Through Love in Action's heavily supervised program and strict dress code, Connolly was forced to take his moral inventory each night by focusing solely on his sinfulness, conform to stereotypically gendered ideas about how to walk and talk as a man, and listen to lectures on masculinity. Terrorizing and brutal, Love in Action worked to expunge everything individual and true about those who came through its doors. Confronted with continuing his journey into the ex-gay world, Connolly found the strength and courage to stop attempting a false life and instead to find his own way in the world. Again, he writes about this in his new memoir, Boy Erased, and we welcome Garrett Connolly to the roundtable this morning. Garrett, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So at what point did you think that you wanted to tell this story and share it with others?
Well, I didn't talk about the subject for about 8 years after it happened, so I was sent to ex-gay therapy. I was so embarrassed by the idea of it, because after I sort of recovered from some of the brainwashing techniques, I just thought, well, I'm not going to go tell everyone this because I don't want them to feel sorry for me. But then, when I would tell people that were really close to me, their first reaction would be, how could any parent do this to a child? And so that was an interesting question to me, because growing up in the South, it was very clear to me how a parent could do that to a child and how an entire town could do that to someone. And so I sort of just wanted to answer that question in book form and let the two cultures sort of see each other, the Southern evangelical culture and the educated liberal culture, which I belong to both at different points in my life.
So let's do a little bit of the background. You're the son of a Baptist pastor. You grew up in a small town in Arkansas. You would go to church three times a week. How old were you when you were outed to your parents?
I was 19 when I was technically outed to my parents. So the person who raped me at my school, it's getting heavy here, called my parents and told them that I was gay as a way to sort of cover up what had happened. And so that was when I spoke to my father, and he gave me an ultimatum that I needed to either go to ex-gay therapy or I would lose my family. That was when we decided to enroll in Love in Action, which was based in Memphis, Tennessee.
This is the largest ex-gay therapy organization in the country with a mission to cure those of homosexuality.
Yes.
How soon after that incident to when you actually went to Love in Action?
So the incident was around, it was before Thanksgiving, my freshman year of college. And then we went through a very long process. So we went to several therapy sessions in Memphis to a person's office that was connected with Love in Action. And they had to approve my application. And so part of that application process was through the talks with a marriage counselor. And then the other part was a very long application that basically described any sexual experiences that you've had. It asked me to list off any forms of idolatry I was involved in, and that list involved things like Dungeons and Dragons or any astrological sign information that you dabbled in. So it was quite an extensive list of idolatrous acts that I could choose from. And then after submitting that application, I had to do a few supplementary essays, and then they would review it and decide if I would go. And so they decided that I was ready for it.
So what goes into that process in the sense of how do they make the determination that you are right or not right for the program?
Well, I think, I mean, I don't know because a lot of their methods were secretive, but I believe that they determined it based on my willingness to approach Love in Action with an open mind. And I'm using that term in sort of the way that they would consider it to be an open mind. Like, am I willing to admit that perhaps something in my life is horribly wrong and I need God's help to survive what I'm going through? And you know, they used a lot of scare tactics. So I believe that they wanted me to be prepared to have this sort of second conversion, because I'd always grown up in a religious household, missionary Baptist preacher for a father. And, you know, I think that was a big reason why they chose me, because they knew that I'd already been steeped in it and I was receptive to it.
Once you go and you are accepted into the program, roughly how many people are you with?
My group in the mornings, I believe it was around 16 to 18 people. And it was a range of different types of people. So there were people there who were dealing with issues of bestiality, homosexuality, obviously. There were also people there dealing with pedophilia. So we had these morning groups where everyone was combined in what was called a rap session. And then we would break off into smaller groups based on what our sinful issue was. There were also married people who had affairs of the same sex nature.
It seems that this goes without saying, but let me ask the question anyway, which is, I'm assuming you don't have a lot in common with the people that you're in the group who are there for bestiality or pedophilia.
No, yeah. But see, one of the things about growing up in the South and hearing all of the bigotry, you know, your whole life, is that you hear these conflated notions of, okay, well, if they're gay, then they're also going to have sex with an animal, or, you know, if they do that, then they'll also prey upon children. And it's in the culture, you know, still to this day in certain pockets of the country, where teachers that are out are often considered suspect in some way, or, you know, potential predators. And so I believe that a lot of that thinking came from those stereotypes and those really harmful ideas. And they aren't even really stereotypes, because, you know, it's just not true.
Right.
But those harmful ideas were just already in the culture at the time. And I think that a lot of these counselors had internalized the homophobia that had been directed at them initially and decided that the only way to cure it was to sort of believe what the culture at large had told them and try to fix whatever was wrong with people.
I asked the question about not having in common with those in the group. So I understand the lumping together on behalf of the organization, but
mm-hmm.
for you, there wouldn't be finding much commonality with those that you are
no.
with.
No.
Right.
Well, at the time there wasn't. You know, but I've since learned to sort of feel for these people that were sort of in this situation. Like this girl that was there because of the bestiality issue, I don't have a lot in common with her. I've never had that experience and I've never had that impulse. But, you know, just like she probably needed a therapist to deal with some of these issues, and it was sad that we were all grouped together in the same pop psychology religious facility that didn't really know how to treat anyone that attended it.
That is something that I wanted to ask you. You write about this in the book. The credentials of the people who were teaching you, quote unquote, curing you,
mm-hmm.
very random, right?
Yeah, yeah. So one of the counselors, he had gone through Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was his credential. And then there were people that were marriage counselors, and I'm not really sure exactly what everyone's credentials were, because some of this information is really difficult to find, and it's difficult to contact some of these people today. But that was one of the things that my mom picked up on whenever she came to pick me up one of those days that I was at Love in Action, and she said, like, what exactly are these people's qualifications? Which seems like an obvious question for a parent to have asked before sending someone into ex-gay therapy, but we were so completely steeped in this idea that something had to be done that we didn't even question the credentials until much later.
What year did you go?
2004.
So this isn't that long ago.
No, and that's what's always shocking to people when I tell them this story, is they're like, well, this sort of thing doesn't go on today, right? And, you know, it actually does. And it's nothing quite as big as Love in Action or Exodus International, which was the larger umbrella group that Love in Action was working under. But there are only 5 states that have actually banned conversion therapy for minors specifically.
This is an ongoing question in many states that are looking to ban it. Was it immediate that you started to think that this was just wrong and that this was quite brutal and terrorizing?
Well, it's really difficult to extricate yourself from years of what I would consider to be a type of brainwashing.
Sure.
So when I went to Love in Action, I was, of course, questioning, you know, I'd gone through 1 year of, you know, my freshman year at a really great liberal arts college. And so I was reading this wonderful literature and sort of seeing a more nuanced view of the world. And that was coming up against 18 years of, you know, being involved in the Missionary Baptist Church and going to church 3 times a week. And so the best way I can describe it is through just, you know, the idea of cognitive dissonance. I understood on a deeper level that what I was doing to myself and what they were doing to me was perhaps harmful, but on the very basic survival mode, you know, of like my identity as someone who'd grown up in this church and my identity as a son and only child, I wanted to keep the things that I loved intact, and I was afraid I was going to lose everything that I understood about the world. And the idea of being cut off, you know, my parents weren't going to pay for my college if I didn't do this, and the idea of being cut off from my family, from education, and from everything I had known was so terrifying to me that I was just willing to keep an open mind about this therapy.
Did you find a glimpse of compassion with one parent over the other as this process went on?
Yes. So my father stayed behind. We were in a small town in the Ozarks, and he stayed behind because he had a lot of preaching stuff to do, and he was actually about to be ordained as a preacher. So he was ordained as a preacher halfway through my service, and we had to come back. My mom and I went back to a service so that he could be ordained, and we had to stand on a stage while everyone officially made him a preacher. And he'd been doing preaching stuff before that, but he hadn't been completely finalized as a preacher. And so this was a very trying time for all of us because so much was going on. And my mom and I went to Love in Action together, stayed in this hotel room, and during the day I would go to Love in Action, and she would go back to the hotel room and sort of, I later learned, she would pull the covers up over her and just cry all day. And so she was certainly feeling close to me at that time, and I felt very distant from her until, you know, the last day I was there, it was about halfway through the second week of therapy, she started to ask questions, and she asked me finally when I got in the car, are you going to kill yourself? And I said yes. And I believed it, but I also knew that it was the answer that might make her make a decision for me. And she said, well, I don't want a dead son. Like, I would rather have you. And it was a very emotional moment. And we, you know, she was like, I'm taking you away from this place. after that moment, we'd always been close, but after that moment, we knew we were on this journey together, because we had to go back home to my father and let him know that this was a decision we made. And that was a very it was a very trying time for us.
So once this goes through, are you able to, and you write about this and mm-hmm. quite beautifully, but you write about this as to how then you start to have relationships, and it was extremely hard for you because
yeah.
of all of that for the 18, 20 years prior to that, of being told what you're feeling, what you're how you're feeling is sinful and a way of losing your entire family.
Yeah, I mean, many of the things that they teach you at a place like Love in Action are that, you know, you're disgusting, your impulses are wrong, they're from the devil. There are small things like the way you stand can be observed and considered to be a false image, which is another borrowing from Alcoholics Anonymous. So if I stood with my hand on my hip, somebody could come up to me and say, that is a false image, the way you're holding yourself is wrong, you're too effeminate. And so on that basic body level, it's really hard to come into contact with other people, even to this day. You know, sometimes when my boyfriend and I are, like, just trying to be, you know, nice to each other, or just on the street, like, he'll grab my hand or something like that, I will feel terrified and disgusted. And it's really painful, because I have to really walk myself through the process of, okay, this is okay, you're not going to hell. If you're being slightly effeminate, it's okay as well. It doesn't mean you're not a man. It doesn't mean that your gender is being questioned. It's just really frustrating to have to walk through that process every time you want to be close to someone that you love.
Do you think there will be a time where those public displays of affection do not affect you in such a way?
I hope so. I mean, I work toward it almost every day. And, you know, I've been lucky enough to find people in my life that understand my intimacy issues, and are willing to work with me on that. And, you know, I've found that there are just many ways to express affection, and if people know that you're working on it, then they're often really nice about it. But it's so frustrating to always have to have this conversation with people that you're getting closer to.
You live in Bulgaria.
I do currently teach and live in Bulgaria. My boyfriend just got a Fulbright, though, to go to UC Davis. So I don't know exactly what I'm doing next year.
So the question is, do you find yourself, even in going to, from going from Arkansas to Bulgaria in mm-hmm. 10 years is a fairly radical step. So
yeah.
Are you escaping in that point? And is there a sense that if you do come home or you do come back to the States, that will be more of a an acceptance for you?
Well, so one of the things that I did right after I finished college was I went into Peace Corps in Ukraine, because I really wanted to see a different side of the world and sort of question what was the same and what was radically different. And so when I went to Ukraine to do my service, I, you know, went into different churches, Eastern Orthodox churches, and saw how people worshiped. And I visited these families and saw how they worked. And it was very healing for me to realize that my experience had been very singular, in many ways unique. You know, it was very helpful for me personally. And so now, when I come back to Arkansas, I have a little bit more perspective, and I don't feel claustrophobic in the same way I used to feel, because now I have a different life somewhere else. And I remember the first time I was in Ukraine, like the first night, I was with this host family, and they finally went to bed. And I remember sitting on my bed and thinking, no one could really find me, even if they wanted to. And I really loved that thought. you know, I've since reconnected with my past, obviously, and I have more perspective on it. But I needed that time and that distance to sort of come to terms with what had actually happened to me.
Did traditional therapy come into the picture?
No, I am still really reticent of therapy. That's another thing that Love in Action really messed up for me. When people tell me perfectly reasonable things in therapy, which I've done a few trial sessions, I'm suspect. I get very suspicious. It's really hard to navigate a brain that is suspicious of almost everything that people tell you is like the right thing to do. So that's another thing that really was difficult for a while.
Well, the difference being, of course, that it's not to change who you are,
of
but
course.
To understand who you are.
Mm-hmm. And I know that rationally, but because I've been in those offices under, you know, and those offices were operating under the term therapy, there's a lot of trauma that sort of comes up that feels very uncomfortable and doesn't feel like the best venue for it to be cured. I hate to use that word.
So let's use it again. Are you cured of ex-gay in the sense of that you will fully identify and be proud of the homosexuality?
Yes. I'm completely cured of that notion of ex-gay. Some people call it ex-ex-gay, which is really confusing if you aren't part of the conversation. But yeah, I'm very proud to be part of the LGBTQ spectrum. And, you know, I teach a lot of students in Bulgaria, and I always mention LGBTQ rights, and I volunteer for the pride parades and stuff. And yeah, I mean, I consider myself to be a gay activist. So I did cure myself of that.
And yet you still have that moment where it doesn't feel right.
Yeah, and that's just, I 100% believe that I have those problems because of what the therapy did to me.
Yeah.
Because I have plenty of friends that do not feel that way at all. I think it's possible to one day get over what they've done.
You made this point earlier, but organizations like this still exist.
They do, although it's more difficult to track them. When Exodus International was huge, they were in many countries, and there were over 200 smaller organizations within Exodus International, and Love in Action was one of the largest ones. So these places, some of them have gone underground. Some of them are just available at churches. But it's really hard to get straight answers from people about whether or not they're doing ex-gay therapy because, you know, even though the subject is not necessarily mainstream, it's certainly in those circles, they know that it's being talked about negatively. You know, they're sort of going underground.
You were talking a moment ago about, you know, rationally you can talk to yourself and say, well, I know this isn't rational. But when you were writing the book, did you still look at the page at what you'd written and about the experience you'd had and say, wow, this is really, really f***ed up?
Yeah, I mean, I did. There were moments when I thought, okay, because I still have my 274-page handbook from ex-gay therapy, which I smuggled out. And I would like turn to these pages and be like, wow, this is like the craziest thing in the world, and when people read this, it's going to be really shocking. And so, yeah, there was a direct intention to sometimes shock the reader with the information because I felt like, you know, if you haven't been part of this world, it's time for you to see, like, sort of what's underneath the hood, like how this sort of bigotry operated and just how many different iterations of bigotry there can be and how strange and unusual they can be. The original title of the book was Signs and Wonders, which was from the verse in Matthew because I just thought it's such a wonder that this thing ever existed in in the most bizarre sense of the term, that that people thought, well, we should combine the Bible with Alcoholics Anonymous and also pop psychology, and let's throw in a little bit of Freud and see if that works.
Do you think your parents are ultimately proud of you?
I do. They've known since I was about 10. I would, march into the living room and announce that I was going to be an author. They just didn't know it would be this book. So it's been interesting to hear the ways that, for example, my father has worked around some of our issues. He'll say, I'm so proud of you. You're really doing what you always wanted to do. But we'll just sort of talk around what the book is about. And then he'll always ask, what's the next thing you're going to do? When are you going to write a real book? Like, this is a real book, Dad. So.
And not without prying too much, but I mean, if you were to marry your boyfriend, would he come?
Well, I had kind of an altercation with my dad last summer, and I said, I have a boyfriend. If and when he comes here and he sits down at the table, what are we going to do about it? And my dad said that he would have to walk out. And I said, okay, well, you can walk out and then you can come back in. But this is my house too, and this is my family. That's where we are. He loves me. In many ways, he supports me. We have a real relationship. But there are certain things that he, as a missionary Baptist preacher, he really believes that it would be a compromise to everything that he cares about to sit at the dinner table with me and my boyfriend.
Well, the book is fascinating and a hell of a story. It is Boy Erased, a memoir. It is published by Riverhead Books. Garrett Connolly, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. Great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Best of luck to you. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Boy Erased, a memoir published by Riverhead. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.